I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Southeast Asia is one of the most dynamic in embracing that digital economy and has great potential going forward in the next decade or two because of its young and very connected populations.
I think if Australia was to adopt a strategy to engage Southeast Asia, it should really center on making the region more secure, prosperous, stable, and autonomous, especially in the face of growing great power competition.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast, brought to you by the ANU National Security College, with support from policyforum.net. In this episode, Principal Policy Fellow at the Perth US Asia Centre, Dr. Huang Lithu, and PhD candidate at the ANU Coral Bell School of Asia Pacific Affairs, Gatra Priyandita, joined Dr. Will Stoltz to discuss how Southeast Asia's technology and development needs intersect with geopolitics and great power competition in the region. Before we get into it, we'd like to acknowledge and celebrate the Ngambri and Ngunnawal people, the traditional owners of the land from which we broadcast. We pay our respects to their elders past, present, and emerging.
Well, Huang, Gatra, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks so much for having us.
So I really wanted to dive into, I suppose, a broad-ranging discussion about the nature of geopolitics in Southeast Asia at the moment. And I wanted to start the conversation very explicitly avoiding the kind of great power competition that so often dominates these discussions and speak perhaps more more specifically about the, the contests and tensions, but perhaps opportunities and evolving relationships within Southeast Asia at the moment. So I suppose it'd be great to get your overview of, the status of the region at the moment. What are the big kind of shifts in the balance of power, so to speak, within the region? So I might go to Gatra, you to kick us off there, and then Huang, I'd love your thoughts as well.
Sure. Look, I think there's a tendency to still talk about the balance of power in Southeast Asia from the, from a US-China angle for several reasons. Firstly, the U.S. and China do maintain a considerable sizable military footprints in the area. China has expanded its South Seas fleet, including, adding an aircraft carrier into its fleet. And the United States also maintains extensive defense networks, both in the form of military alliances with the Philippines and Vietnam, Philippines and Thailand, and other extensive defense partnerships with Vietnam and Singapore as well. Part of the reason why all talks about the balance of power in Southeast Asia focus on those two countries is because, at the end of the day, Southeast Asia is still a collection of medium-sized and small states, and no single state has the capacity to exert, any form of potential hegemony even over the entire region. You have countries like Vietnam, which probably can exert some influence over its neighboring countries like Laos and Cambodia, but Vietnam is incapable of doing so across the entire region. I think traditionally we talk about Indonesia being the leader of ASEAN, right? The primus inter pares, force among equals. And talks about Indonesia as a leader really focus on its, firstly, it's based on its size, but also that it does oftentimes, historically at least, provide solutions to major foreign policy problems in the region since the establishment of ASEAN. It's played a bridge-building role in conflicts, mediating role in conflicts in southern Philippines, for example. It's also played an important role in mediating even disputes between leaders within ASEAN, in Thailand and Cambodia most recently, the Phya Vihear Temple dispute. And it's also been a strong advocate of ASEAN centrality. Mm. It's always advocated that ASEAN becomes the regional architecture in the Asia Pacific becomes ASEAN centered. That doesn't mean that no other country in the region can exert any form of leadership. Thailand, during the Third Indochina War, was probably quite important in driving ASEAN's agenda. Mm. In the same vein, Vietnam is pretty important in engaging Cambodia and Laos to counter Chinese influence. And, you know, Vietnam, even after the 2012 ASEAN summit, where the Cambodian chairmanship failed to agree on a joint communique because of the South China Sea disputes, Vietnam continues to engage, be in favor of engaging Cambodia and Laos. But demonstrative of the growing complexity of the interlink and you know, functional cooperation in the region as well, many other countries have play important functional roles and functional leadership roles. So on regulations concerning international airspace, for example, Singapore and Malaysia have shown the political will for the implementation of the open skies against the background of expanding national airlines. On labor mobility, meanwhile, Singapore, Malaysia, and Thailand are the biggest advocates of smoother mobility to allow influx of qualified workers from other ASEAN member states because of their own aging populations. And the Philippines is pretty important when it comes to discussions on illegal migration.
Mm-hmm. Hoang, what's your kind of assessment of whether the center of gravity of leadership in the region is changing, or is it, Gatra there mentioned the status of Indonesia, are these things fairly fixed, or are you detecting a degree of change at the moment?
There is a lot of fluidity, I would say, in Southeast Asia at the moment, and you can feel the pressure of the geopolitics very heavily on the shoulders of Southeast Asian countries. I just came back for 2 months in the region, and I think that pressure is felt not only from the geopolitics side that Gatha briefly mentioned, but also, it is simultaneously with the pressure on the economic recovery from the post-pandemic. The countries really have the desire to bounce back, but are constrained by geopolitical factors, including the great power competition, but also the war between Russia and Ukraine that also fuels things like fuel prices and food prices and food scarcities. So on top of the geopolitics, or linked to that and directly linked to that, is also geoeconomics. And I think that kind of pressure from multiple fronts is something that Southeast Asians are really struggling with at the moment, because for a long, long time, they were used to a more stable environment where they could almost solely focus on the development and economic development in particular. But as the geopolitical environment and tensions intensify, I think it is, first of all, very distracting. Second of all, this sense of instability, pressure of taking sides or making choices in different contexts. And at the same time, all of that, and their personal individual countries' performance also will affect their own governance stability. So I think what I pick up from the 2 months in the region is that accumulation of pressures, both external and internal, that is really challenging the region at the moment. And also that it affects the balance that you were asking, and the regional balance, and because each of a country's individual strategies are adapting to the changing environment. And it's not easy that if the environment is changing so fast, it's not in the comfort zone of the leaders in the region to be shifting their policies so fast. So you'll see that a lot of times Southeast Asian leaders in particular want to deny that great power competition, want to deny that zero-sum kind of framing, or want to deny even, the reverse effect or anti-globalism. They would want the world to be, back to the normal, back to great powers, the US and China, can work with each other, back to the favorable conditions of globalization, where Southeast Asia and their economies have, a very fixed place. But I think that is not necessarily what is happening. And not all countries have figured out or have, ready strategies at place. And they are also as well, struggling to make things as we go, as the great power competition and geopolitical global conditions are evolving. So you'll see a lot of sense of instability, a little bit of insecurity, tension, and a lot of pressure to perform well despite all of those challenges altogether.
It's a fascinating insight and great to get it from you, having returned from a tour of the region so soon. I mean, Gatra, it's kind of building off what Huang's mentioned there. It sounds to me like that there is a real risk that there's going to be, in domestic politics in a number of Southeast Asian countries, a kind of real tension between immediate needs versus long-term needs. I mean, would that be fair to say that this is going to be a wide-sweeping challenge for a number of Southeast Asian countries within, you know, the domestic political settings?
Definitely. So a lot of Southeast Asian governments are basing their regime legitimacy based on economic performance. Mm. And, you know, this is obviously the case in many more authoritarian states, but in a few of the democratic states as well, like Indonesia, economic development constitutes an important priority, right? And because of this, the focus oftentimes is to look for short-term economic gains for the political leaders and, not focus enough on the potential security risks and aspects of it.
Mm. So we've kind of been speaking around the great power tension that's kind of the backdrop, and I want to go to it a little bit more directly. And this might, in some sense, be a fairly intuitive question, but one that we perhaps don't necessarily articulate all that frequently. And Huang, I'll go to you on this. And the question is, I mean, what are China's long-term strategic objectives in Southeast Asia? And I suppose, how are they seeking to achieve it? It's, you know, that's perhaps a big question, but Huang, I'm interested to see your response to that one.
I think intuitively or not, China wants a region to be a stable one. So, for example, when the coup in Myanmar happened, I don't think that was, welcome in China either way. And any unexpected changes or volatile changes is not welcome in China either, because they also pay. Beijing puts a lot of effort in building relationship, especially with the leadership in the countries. So it takes time to forge those relationships. And so, you know, too often changes of government is also not very well seen from Beijing. But in general, I think stability, because, you know, stability in what they perceive as periphery, as they call often Southeast Asia, is one also of preconditions for their own security, right? Another objective is, you know, good relationship with Southeast Asians individually, but also collectively. So China wouldn't want to see Southeast Asian in any ways, in a solidarity upon one issue that is contrasting China's views. So, for example, South China Sea or Mekong or any other issue that, the Southeast Asian would speak with one voice, that would differ from the Beijing's voice. So that's quite successfully implemented in a way that ASEAN has not yet gained the successful consensus over the, for example, one voice in South China Sea. China wants the regional dispute to be bilateral rather than, you know, ASEAN dispute versus China, ASEAN's claims versus China claims, but individual countries' claims, for example. So in that way, you know, China's, but to achieve that, it is very actively feeding the narrative and actively making sure that Beijing's friendly narrative or preventing, you know, any hostile narrative to spread across the region and to spread, you know, make ASEAN speak with one voice that is unfavorable to Beijing. And equally the same would be, their view when it comes to Taiwan. It hopes that Southeast Asia recognize only China, the mainland China only, one China policy, and prevent any, you know, discord in that regard. And I think they're doing quite successfully, because judging from a recent survey from the Democracy Perception Index, majority of Southeast Asian countries in the scenario where Beijing would invade Taiwan, would not abandon their one China policy. So I think if judging from that kind of surveys, China's objective is on a good track to be achieved in Southeast Asia. On other side, taking a little bit longer historical perspective, I had this conversation with the Vietnamese recently, is that, this is a new phase, this is a new era, because historically speaking, China has tried to invade and occupy Southeast Asia many times, and Vietnam being at the frontier of that. It was never very successful, of course. There was, times of occupation, but a lot of resistance. And actually, the geography of Southeast Asia had prevented China from further southbound movement. But now, in a different era, with different era of technology, connection, infrastructure, China is making inroads throughout Southeast Asia thanks to its investments in infrastructure, railway building, even ports, allegedly even a base in Cambodia, right? So through infrastructure, and of course through less tangible things like digital connection, China is making inroads throughout Southeast Asia, and it's present, very, very deep south across Southeast Asia. So it doesn't need to physically invade like it used to in the history. So that's actually a very good point that, its presence doesn't need to be taken by force, but thanks to the technology, it is present much more than it could in the past.
Yeah, that's a fascinating insight. I mean, it struck me that your answer emphasizing that China's overall objective is to favor stability in the region is a really interesting one when it does come to how they respond to ASEAN. I mean, there seems to be somewhat of a paradox in place to, ASEAN is a backbone for security of the region, but won't necessarily be favorable or accommodating or welcoming of kind of China's kind of quite hegemonic approach to wanting to lead the region. So, Gatra, I'd be kind of interested to get your response to that issue of how China should be or is interacting with ASEAN.
So I think China finds ASEAN as a regional organization to be a very favorable diplomatic partner, in part because of its diplomatic style is compatible with that of China's own. International relations in ASEAN is very much shaped by the flexible and non-binding nature of the ASEAN way, a principle that underlines the sacrosanct nature of sovereignty. And ASEAN offers Beijing a non-confrontational, consensus-based mechanism for addressing regional issues that is obviously a stark contrast to how multilateral institutions that, quote-unquote, are dominated by the West would function, right?
Mm.
Like ASEAN, China's own diplomatic style has traditionally tended to focus more on forms and substance. This is reflected in things like the South China Sea disputes where there's at the moment, I guess there's a mutual preference. Beijing has been advocating for vague and easily circumvented agreements, such as the Treaty of Amity and Cooperation and the Declaration of Conduct on the South China Sea. And in contrast, it's relatively less enthusiastic about a code of conduct, which many member states of ASEAN, including Indonesia, for example, are encouraging for something that's more binding.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, well, I want to go to something that Huang mentioned before, which is the role of digital economy and infrastructure and investment as a geopolitical tool or element in this. I mean, speaking, I suppose, specifically on the digital opportunities for Southeast Asian economies, I mean, what are the key development initiatives that that countries need to see at the moment, and I suppose what are the real the frontline issues potentially in countries like Indonesia? Because I know, Gatra, you've recently published a paper on this topic.
So when we talk about Southeast Asia's digital landscape, I think it's really important to set the scene by highlighting some key numbers and statistics. Southeast Asia, as a block, I guess, has a population of around 660 million people. and an average internet penetration rate of around 70%. So overall, 460 million people probably use the internet to shop, communicate, do business, and learn. And 40 million of these people only became connected in 2020, 2021 because of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Wow.
And, you know, the internet economy is expected to, in the region, is expected to reach around $1 trillion sometime this decade. And, you know, the region's already producing, you know, around over 20 unicorns. Compare that to like 10 years ago when only a couple were probably around. Now, many Southeast Asian governments are banking on rapid digital transformation to bolster their economies, as well as address potential socioeconomic challenges like unequal access to education and public services. But the biggest problem for many of these countries, especially in places like Indonesia, and of course like the Philippines and Vietnam as well, are skills and infrastructure. You know, a 2018 World Bank report found, for example, that Indonesia was facing serious ICT skill shortages and projected that Indonesia needed 9 million skilled and semi-skilled ICT workers by 2030. So the primary risk for a lot of these countries is that digital development fails and then vital jobs never emerge, leading to slower economic growth and, you know, less competitive economic ecosystem. Chinese tech ICT companies like Huawei and ZTE have long recognized the need for boosting human capital in countries like Indonesia. They've offered, you know, plenty of training programs, not just at the, you know, at the professional level, but also at the university level and vocational school level as well. So China organizes the Luban workshops, for example. You know, there's like, I think over 20 of them now. Which focuses on digital training. It also engages with government officials. So Indonesia's cybersecurity agency, BSSN, has a capacity building agreement with Huawei. And Huawei has claimed to have trained up to 7,000 people. So they're really delivering on the need for human skills, skills development in these countries. And at the same time, they're providing the infrastructure that's very much needed at a price that's very competitive. And in part, the relatively lower cost of these equipment, telecoms equipment, like on 5G and all that, is because of export credits.
Huang, this issue really kind of gets to the point that you made before about there being something, I suppose, of an incentive in Southeast Asia to not let certain development issues be starkly framed as geopolitical, no?
Yes, indeed. And I think, you know, digital economy or digitalization has become such a buzzword in the region. And there's so much enthusiasm about it because it's seen as one of the ways, if not the way out from the pandemic-induced economic stagnation, you know. Especially digital economy over the pandemic years has replaced in many ways the income that would be normally generated from traditional main sectors of the economy in most of the countries in Southeast Asia, which is tourism, services, manufacturing, and even just to a degree, education, everything was online. And while the pandemic and restrictions, social restrictions were in place, people couldn't do the traditional services or tourism wasn't back. So everything moved on to the digital platform. And as Gatha mentioned, Southeast Asia is one of the most dynamic in embracing that digital economy and has great potential going forward in the next decade or two because of its young and very connected population. So there is a lot of hopes and expectations towards this sector and, you know, even Indonesia chairing this year's G20 took digital economy as one of the key pillars. And equally in the ASEAN framework, this year's Cambodia's chair and plans of post-pandemic recovery, everything is really focusing on digital economy and digital trade. So it is certainly an area of growth, but it is also very much an uneven area because, like Gatha mentioned, the infrastructure base is very much uneven and the skills are still missing. Another thing I would highlight is the cybersecurity side. Mm-hmm. So everyone is online having at least one or two phones, everyone has e-wallets and online payment, but the level of security, both personal and financial, are very, very, you know, diverse. So, the countries also using different providers, different standards. So I think what we will face ahead is the harmonization of the standards in the region. That will be something that as we go along and as the digital adoption goes so fast, we will have challenges in catching up with those standards, particularly when it comes to cybersecurity and safety of data and protection of data, especially that each ASEAN countries have very dissimilar legal framework and regulations. So that would be, you know, at the moment is a phase of enthusiasm and euphoria about the digital prospects and opportunities it can bring. But I think we'll be very soon hit by the reality of more stark and more, you know, dangerous things that can come with that, which is the cybersecurity framework.
Mm. Something that strikes me as quite, I suppose, strange and problematic about this discussion about the digital opportunities in Southeast Asia is that often we kind of talk about this being kind of this binary choice for a lot of developing countries in the region between a kind of Chinese technology ecosystem and Chinese-backed investment and a Western or US-led technology ecosystem and investment, and they've got to make a choice, or they've got, or the external forces are pushing them to a point of needing to choose. But kind of to what Gatra's research has pointed out is that, well, there isn't a choice in the sense that Indonesia, you know, if they've got all these people who have been educated by Chinese institutions, that they can't remove those people from the system. You know, they've already started to embark down, I suppose, a hybrid model where they've got an economy that's supported by both Chinese-based corporations and Chinese infrastructure and Western corporations and Western infrastructure. So I wonder if we need to move beyond that discussion of looking at this as a choice, because it's far more complicated than that. And I suppose, is there really a risk in Southeast Asia of a kind of bifurcated digital society, in the sense that you will have some countries on one side of the so-called, you know, a digital wall, and people and other countries on another side? Or is it going to be much more of a kind of muddled up system? Gatra, I'd be interested in your response to that.
Oh, well, I think the digital ecosystem, or the telecoms equipment ecosystem in Southeast Asia and Indonesia as well, specifically, I guess, is generally quite heterogeneous, right?
Mm.
It's not just Huawei and ZTE getting involved in these things. You know, Ericsson and Nokia are also big players. And in fact, you know, after Huawei, I think it is Nokia that's number two.
Mm.
There is the challenge, I think, in the long run that, especially if we see greater tech competition between the United States and China, you know, perhaps even a reluctance for interoperability between systems, that the telecommunications ecosystem in the region can be, muddled up. And because, Huawei technology, for example, is used for 5G. Construction in Indonesia, but that's going to be used primarily for urban areas where 5G will probably be most useful. You know, Indonesia is an archipelagic nation of 17,000 islands. For rural areas on the islands, they're probably going to use Open RAN instead, which Huawei doesn't have the technology for. So I think it'll be a problematic in the long run. It's not that Indonesian officials are not reaching out to other telecom equipment providers. A lot of them just struggle to compete with Huawei because of the prices, but also because of the added benefits, namely, you know, human capital training, for example.
Mm.
As I've recently argued with Dirk van der Klee and Ben Herskovich in a recent paper that NEC produced, we're really encouraging Quad countries, Australia included, of course, to invest more in vocational training in Indonesia specifically, but also see broadly more Southeast Asia, because this will introduce, firstly, it will help Indonesia meet its human skills development needs. At the same time, it will also encourage, hopefully, more interactions between telecom providers in the Quad countries and in Indonesia.
We'll be right back.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists, and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Huang, Gatra mentioned the potential for the Quad be engaging in kind of more proactive development investment in Southeast Asia, and we're obviously very aware of vehicles like One Belt One Road on behalf of China. I mean, what are the kind of other development investment programs that we should be watching out and that are potentially going to have a kind of significant impact on the region?
Sure. Could I go back to that digital iron cotton question first?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Actually, I wrote an article about the Southeast Asian views on the Huawei ban and what that means for the regional technology standards a couple of years ago. And my finding was that, of course, there was a worry about, evolving digital cotton with when US announced a Huawei ban. But I think in Southeast Asia, it would be very difficult adopt that ban. And in fact, none of Southeast Asians, even if they didn't choose Huawei, none of the Southeast Asians did formally ban Huawei in participating in critical infrastructure or 5G biddings in their countries, even if they didn't opt for that. They won't formally ban Huawei just because possibly a political aspect of that, but also because Huawei was there to build the previous technologies, including 3G and whatnot. So it would be very difficult to cut and very costly. Actually, the US is paying a big billions to clean up from Huawei and ZTE and other Chinese technologies. So it's not going to be a cost that many of the Southeast Asian countries will want to bear. Mm. And second of all, I think, if you look at that bifurcation, right, actually two of US treaty allies in the region, the Philippines and Thailand, went for Huawei in one way or another in their technology. So it doesn't really necessitate, the like-mindedness or alignment in their choices. I think it comes to more than just political choices. It also is about availability and affordability. What are the potential alternatives, if not Huawei, right? Ready and affordable for the countries to choose from. And even countries like I said, Vietnam or Singapore, that didn't opt for Huawei. They didn't ban it, and in fact, they are engaging with other Chinese technological companies, intensively. For example, Singapore hosts the regional Alibaba's headquarters in the region. So it's not one choice means nothing at all. I don't think it would be ever possible for this region to clear out from the Chinese technology there. And, Cambodia, Laos, Myanmar have adopted the Chinese technologies. And even, it's not just about 5G, but other aspect. For example, for the Philippines, under President Duterte, who had such a great focus on public security with his own campaign on anti-drug wars, the camera and surveillance systems were provided heavily by China. So it's already embedded in the system. Mm. Or in terms of e-payment and online banking, a lot of technologies also in Thailand, for example, come from the Chinese companies. The Alibaba and other Chinese companies also built innovation hubs across the region and given training. So it doesn't stop at 5G. It doesn't stop at what we call here in Australia, you know, critical infrastructure. It's from the top level to bottom up. And it's really a mixture of different technologies. It's not going to be never a clean cut, whether, you know, Western technologies or Chinese technologies. It's always going to be a big and messy mixture.
Well, and just on that, I suppose, I mean, we often, I mean, kind of based on what you both said, the starting premise is that we assume that the development imperatives and the economic imperatives are the real thing that is driving this choice. But is it also reflective of the fact that these countries just have a very different outlook when it comes to the perceived risk from China, that they've actually just got different security assessments and assessments of their interests, and they actually don't perceive the same degree of threat emanating from these Chinese firms that perhaps we do in Australia? I mean, Huang, what's your kind of reaction to that proposition?
Yes, I think to a degree it's correct. With 5G, the example we just gave, I think for Vietnam was very clear from the beginning that they don't trust, even though they might not say it very publicly, and they went for a combination of home technologies with Viettel, with Nokia, or, you know, mobile phone with Ericsson and stuff like that. And similarly, I think the attitude from Vietnam in many aspects, whether you're talking about technology or infrastructure, the trust to what China offers or Chinese companies offer is very low, not only on the top level of policymakers and decision makers, but also in everyday consumers. And that also applies to everything from vaccines to, you know, products, everyday products. And similarly, I think for Singapore, that when it came to 5G, choices, it also was concerned about security and data safety. Whereas, and Gautam might have more details on that, whereas, for example, probably main decision factors in Indonesia and other countries was not so much security, but more of affordability and accessibility. And that comes back to the, you know, the basics of the fundamentals of the relationship, I think. Jakarta might think that it's able to manage the relationship with Beijing and there's no immediate threat or risk that would, put their national security in compromise in one way or another. And therefore, you know, the considerations become mostly of the economic factors or convenient factors rather than security factors. So I think there is that element in that as well when we talk about big government decisions. But when we talk about consumer decisions, I think it's mostly very few people, maybe only with the exception of the Vietnamese, would think about, you know, how secure and who owns that company. And I think it's just really about affordability and coverage of the area that they are living and working on in.
I think just to add, there is a general concern, I think, across the region about the implications of a rising China, both in the form of the potential risks of, reduced autonomy or direct security implications, in the case of Vietnam and the Philippines, for example, as well as the possible implications of how the U.S. and other countries might respond to the rise of China. But for many Southeast Asian countries, they've only gained independence within the past 70 years and are more recent to the process of state and nation building. So there are oftentimes more immediate security concerns, and economic insecurity is probably very high up on the list. So it's not that they're concerned; they're not concerned. You know, Indonesia, for example, is not concerned about the possibility of China, using Huawei, of its 5G technology of Huawei installing backdoors into its 5G technology to spy on Indonesian officials. These are concerns as well. It's just that they're number 10 on the list because there's more pressing concerns about being able to provide. We'll get the infrastructure, the telecoms infrastructure needed to sustain and support a digital economy. And when it comes to cybersecurity issues, oftentimes it is issues concerning fraud and data security that's more pressing, because the government is focused on sustaining a strong digital economy, and that requires the trust and support of the people. And if the government, if the people aren't, you know, don't trust that their credit card information, for example, can get stolen, is safe, for example, online, then they're not going to have any trust in digital technology.
Well, I suppose, yeah, that brings us nicely to focus, I suppose, on those other security issues facing the region beyond the great power conflict or great power, you know, competition that's kind of taking, not a conflict yet, competition that's characterizing the region. I suppose, you know, Huang, when you look at the region and you've recently returned, you know, what are the other issues that are really captivating the focus of officials in Southeast Asian countries when it comes to security?
I think food security and energy security is certainly at the top of the mind of leaders as people in the region, but those are also affected by the geopolitics. So I think for the moment, I think the problem is they can't afford prioritization because a lot of challenges are simultaneous and it require equal attention. So that's the challenge. I think they are worried about how they will sustainably rebound from the COVID. I mean, Vietnam is on more positive and optimistic trajectory. So you don't see as much worry as in some other countries that, for example, rely more on tourism services or external tourism, I should say, because, for example, in Vietnam, domestic tourism bounced back quite remarkably. But I think also in terms of something that is in the background that we often don't speak enough about is really the risks from climate crisis, climate-induced changes, and that would affect also food and other resources, natural resources as well. And I don't think there are sufficient framework and investment in resources to mitigate that. And that you know, can range anything from the Mekong sub-region that is a rice bowl for many in the mainland Southeast Asia, but also sea level rise in the coastal countries that would include Indonesia, archipelago country, but also coastline Vietnam and many other in Southeast Asia. So I think the biggest change, a long-term change, will be the climate-related challenges, because this is actually one of the most vulnerable regions. And there are already studies showing millions, if not more, of economic loss of inadequate adaptation to the climate change. And further along, I think more in this sort of a region that is very prone to natural disasters already, and climate only will accelerate that. So I think this is something that we talk about, but I don't think the countries have sufficient framework around it, and certainly not immediate enough.
Gotcha. Do you have anything to add to this discussion about the other kind of security challenges for the region? I mean, I'm noting, for example, we haven't spoken about Myanmar and the issue of you know, failed states, for example.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, there are many internal challenges, right? And security challenges within Southeast Asia that somewhat threaten both unity, ASEAN unity, as well as are potential areas that can cause fights in between Southeast Asian states. And the crisis, the political situation in Myanmar is definitely one of them. You know, since the February 2021 coup, Myanmar has been such a problematic issue for ASEAN leaders. They've come to the 5-point consensus, which has been violated so many times by the Burmese junta, right? I mean, they haven't stopped, the junta hasn't stopped attacking, for example. But beyond that, you know, just as a practical example of what Huang has mentioned, issues concerning climate change and so on, that affects something more practical. Illegal fishing is also probably another internal security challenge facing Southeast Asian states. Now, the South China Sea disputes have exacerbated the threat of IUU fishing, you know, illegal unreported unregulated fishing. And for many navies and coast guards in the region, the prospects of foreign illegal fishers coming into their maritime boundaries has become such an important challenge, simply because, you know, it's a huge industry for many of these countries. It's $3 billion, the fishing industry, $3 billion in Indonesia. And for Vietnam, it's like $1.6 billion.
And I suppose it goes to testing the, you know, law enforcement institutions and these sorts of things, as well as their ability to enforce their sovereign territorial rights as well. So it's a real kind of litmus issue, the fishing issue. Before we run out of time, I want to speak specifically about Australia's future engagement with Southeast Asia. You know, the newly elected Albanese government has had quite good representation across Southeast Asian capitals in its first few months in power. And we've also seen the announcement of the creation of an envoy for Southeast Asia. You know, it strikes me that Australian governments kind of already always have a very strong awareness that Australia needs to improve its engagement with Southeast Asia. And you'll often kind of get that rhetoric of we need to improve. But it's sometimes a little bit unclear of exactly what the kind of long-term goals for that improved engagement should be. I mean, is engagement just an end in and of itself, or do we need to be a little bit more specific here? I mean, Hoang, what do you think Australia should really be doing when it comes to changing its approach to Southeast Asia?
Yeah, I think there is this constant recognition in one government or another that is not, Australia is not doing enough and could do more. But in Southeast Asia in particular, and I think, you know, there have been studies showing that, for example, aid to Southeast Asia were on the decline trend. And that is something that, for example, could be rectified this time around, given that judging from the new government engagement and foreign minister in particular, Penny Wong, there is quite a focus on the region and comfort in engaging with the region, judging from her early visits in the region, in Indonesia, Vietnam, and Malaysia, as well as Singapore recently, in just a few, you know, first 2 months in her office. I think there are a lot of new areas in digital economy, in digital adaptation of technology, and then cybersecurity is one key area to engage with, especially that, you know, Australia on the global scene has quite a reputation and a good standards of the cybersecurity and, you know, protection of critical infrastructure. And there's a lot in areas of training and capacity building, the skills building for the region that Australia can contribute to. So that's one of the policy recommendations that I've also put in my report on digital Southeast Asia, because digital transformation in Southeast Asia will continue because and despite of COVID disruption. And that's probably you know, long-term future growth area. Another thing is climate change, we mentioned, is something also new for this government to be more active on, as opposite to the previous government, but particularly in the area of energy transition. That's something that is very also dynamically happening in the region. And this is also a very energy-hungry region that will need to transform from a more traditional energy to more renewable and sustainable energy sources. And that's where I think Australia can have a lot of influence, given that it's on its own way to realize its renewable energy superpower potential. Hopefully, we'll have more input and imprint in Southeast Asia in that regard. I think education is something, there's another area, probably long-term imprint already that Australia has in the region. And given the region's, like I said, young demographic, but also very strong values of education, this will continuously be a strong card that Australia can draw. And, you know, attracting, becoming an an education hub for the Southeast Asians, and it's actually quite attractive already. But I think using that more wisely and also tapping into the extensive alumni network across Southeast Asia is something that this government should recognize as well.
Gatra, what's your view?
I think if Australia was to think of a strategy to engage Southeast Asia, it should really center on making the region more secure, prosperous, stable, and autonomous, especially in the face of growing great power competition. And this basically means focusing on what these countries need. And Huang, I think, has very eloquently outlined many of the different challenges that Southeast Asian states face, right? And providing assistance on, addressing climate change issues, for example, would be one of them. But of course, one of Australia's greatest strengths is in education and capacity building. And again, vocational training, I think, providing vocational training for digital skills building across the region is one area where Australia can get more involved in. Encouraging research collaboration, focusing on people-to-people ties, cooperation between cybersecurity firms to help improve the digital ecosystem of these countries. It's just probably some of the places where the government can focus on. And I think the government has done quite well in starting this off through, Penny Wong's listening tour, I guess, of the region. Anthony Albanese's also visit to Jakarta was very well received. So I guess more efforts to engage and listen to the needs of these countries would probably be in Australia's long-term best interest.
Well, there's some great insights there from both of you and some excellent policy advice to the new cabinet ministers, and I'm sure they're all listening, and I do hope they've been taking notes. So, Huang, Gatra, thank you so much for making time to speak to the National Security Podcast audience, and we hope to be able to share your insights in future very soon.
Thanks so much for having us.
It's been a pleasure.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.